Resonance Rewind, now approaching its second century of celebrating the wonderful worlds of television and cinematic classics from yesteryear.
Herbert George Wells, Jack the Ripper, 1979, and a Sherlock Holmes mystery in time. Another case of time travel on Resonance Rewind? Let's find out.
The time is 1893, and novelist and inventor H.G. Wells invites you to join him on a flight from London to San Francisco. In under a minute, you will be transported to a bizarre and fantastic new age. Today, time after time. For H.G. Wells, the modern world offers a spectacular array of revelations, embarrassments, and delights.
Well, hello there.
Hello.
What's up, Doc?
I beg your pardon?
You were saying, where to?
Could you please take me as quickly as possible to the Hyatt?
But Wells has not come here as a tourist. His visit will be somewhat more dangerous. For he is pursuing Jack the Ripper, a villain who has eluded his fate by escaping into time.
90 years ago, I was a freak. Today, I'm an amateur. I'm obliged to take you back to face the consequences of your acts.
You take me back? How do you propose to do that? By force?
Be reasonable, John. We don't belong here.
A 19th century gentleman.
What?
You don't close your eyes.
And a 20th century woman.
Well, neither do you.
Join forces to capture a criminal from the past. At large, in the modern world. But even more than they want him, he needs them.
Throw me the key, and I'll release the girl.
On your honor, John.
You have my word as a gentleman. I would have expected that you'd notice by now that I am not a gentleman.
Say goodbye.
Goodbye, Herbert.
You haven't instructed him in the use of one of these machines, have you?
Stevenson!
HG, it's checkmate, and you've lost again.
A romantic adventure, a breathless chase around the world and across a century. Time after time.
Well, it's something when you actually reach the stage of having in your cast list Neil Armstrong, Winston Churchill, Jimi Hendrix, John F. Kennedy, Douglas MacArthur, Edward R. Murrow, and Franklin D. Roosevelt. Of course, that's just part of the passage through time as we travel from 1873 all the way through to 1979 itself, 44 years behind where we actually are. Pamela Sue Mann. I kind of got vibes from Mary Steinberger's character of Amy, of a young Pamela Sue Mann in many ways, naive but feisty, at the same time appreciative of all sorts of things, and maybe actually wanting to work for career for herself in the bank. But what did you make of this particular Nicholas Meyer-directed opus, Time After Time?
Well, we always called her Mary Steinbergen. Is that not her name?
Steinbergen, Steinbergen, it's across the Atlantic, whichever way you wish to use.
What's really funny is that I was doing a mental comparison to her face and Kate Bush.
Yeah.
See them side by side because I think they're doppelgangers. I mean, they couldn't be more different. But, you know, I always remember loving her. I always thought she was really fantastic. So I take that as a compliment, Alex.
Indeed. Indeed. But enough of such delightful things. Would you like to share with us your own thoughts on this Nicholas Meyer-directed movie, which again continues our exploration of H.G. Wells, Jack the Ripper, and of course, other fine folk as well?
I loved it. I mean, I have to say that I was taken aback by the music. I was a little confused as to the time period of the music. But then again, as you can see, time period is what it's about. I mean, it's existing in several times and no time. So it almost, you know, gives the music an out. It could be anything. It could have been Radiohead, which I would have actually loved. But that would have nothing to do with anything. Besides the point, I thought it was great. I loved the time machine. And I have a feeling that Jessica, too, will really have appreciated the time machine. I thought it was very steampunk, very adorable. I wanted to climb into it myself and go to other times. I don't know that I would jump in and follow Jack the Ripper. That's kind of a little scary. But, you know, he did know him very well after all, and somehow didn't know in all that time that his distinguished doctor friend was the one and only Jack the Ripper. But there you go. I loved it. I really did.
As indeed his landlady said, or his housekeeper said, all that time I've been putting his surgical bag away and I never actually knew. Still, there you are. Just goes to show. Okay, let's go to Jessica Burtis then. Jessica, what were your thoughts on Time After After Time, having just freshly watched it in your Dublin base?
No, I have to agree. It was so fun. I wasn't sure what to expect when you kind of mentioned the premise of Jack the Ripper and H.G. Wells and time travel, and I was like, okay, but actually I think it worked really well. I did not expect the jump to the 70s. That was the part that surprised me. I wasn't sure if Jack the Ripper and H.G. Wells were going to chase through time, but it was so fun, much more than I expected.
Okay.
I was just going to say, I think something that I always have to keep in mind whenever I watch something from like the 80s or before is that the pacing is so different compared to movies now. So sometimes it's a bit uncomfortable at first because it moves a bit slower and there's much more dialogue. But I think that it's like, it's really nice actually to have a slower movie to kind of take your time with. So I think it was nice.
Okay. We've heard one or two noises off there. Don't worry, it's not Jack the Ripper. It's just Philip clearing his throat. It's okay. We appreciate that. Philip Hurdwood, let's turn to you next, because I know you're desperately keen to actually get in on this thing. Rather like Jenny, who we'll hear in a few moments. Likewise, we've already heard from Pamela. We were all kind of around at this period of time in history. We might have actually seen it in the cinema. David Warner, of course, who we've seen in recent weeks portray evil in Time Bandits. And, of course, yes. The evil character in Tron, sadly no longer with us, as I say. But what were your thoughts on this particular opus?
Well, I'm probably going to pour cold water over it, really, I expect. I totally take your point, Jessica, about the slowness of the pace. But that was of the time. Things were more leisurely, shall we say. We have shorter attention spans now. I think that has contributed towards it. People want to cut to the chase, quite literally. I have to say, I did really, really like the idea of taking H.G. Wells' time machine concept and just taking that to a very sort of silly extreme. And it was essentially an extremely silly film. And I actually, that's probably part of its charm. I mean, you know, the effects are really dreadful. I thought they were naff. I thought the soundtrack was pretty ghastly. The acting kind of really way over the top. And people were hamming it big time. And it was ham, thickly sliced, I thought. But that's part of its charm. But one thing that did really sort of get up my nose was really the fact that there was that kind of very self-consciously sort of zany tone. And that kind of, I think that rather irritated me after a while. I just thought, come on, it's just, you know, you're piling it on here a bit too much.
Malcolm McDowell, of course, known for his work with Lindsay Anderson and If, and of course, the wonderful world of Clockwork Orange, where he had a whole new aspect. And of course, he's had a fine career since then. Lovely quote that obviously was provided, H.G. Wells's quote, "The first man to raise a fist is the man who's run out of ideas," to which Amy responds, "I love you." Genius. And those are the kind of lines that we appreciate. But Jenny Bill, good to see you. It is indeed the one with Malcolm McDowell. You've obviously survived your training course. Have you managed to catch this movie? And what are your thoughts on Time After Time?
Well, when I actually emailed you, there was a possibility that we were going to finish early today, and I thought, I might actually be able to get back to my dad's in time to watch it and do my and do the stuff, watch it on the train on the way back. And I looked at what it was, and I thought, oh, this looks like a really, really interesting film. It looks like a really interesting idea. I do really like Malcolm McDowell. I think he's excellent. And so I thought, oh yeah, I'm definitely going to watch that. And I was kind of hugely disappointed, I suppose would be a good way to put it. I kind of agree with everything that Philip said. I kind of thought I thought Malcolm McDowell just about held it together with his acting, but I just thought it was kind of kind of stupid, and I just kept thinking, well, that's just really stupid. That's really daft. That's really silly. Well, that wouldn't happen. This wouldn't happen. And I don't mean to sound like I'm just like I want everything to be realistic. But some of the other things, I thought it was a bit cheap as chips, and poor special effects, and yes, over the top acting, over the top music, and I found myself sitting here thinking that I couldn't wait for it to end as it was rolling round towards 7 o'clock. So,
well,
sorry.
There we are. That's the curmudgeonly view, well expressed there.
I am curmudgeonly. I would like to sort of soften my view in a sense that, I think, like I said, I think people expect a faster pace now in films. They want to cut to the narrative and cut to the chase much more quickly. But I think as well, bearing in mind when the film was made, I think, cinema audiences were less sophisticated, at that time. It doesn't mean to sound horrible, about people then, but I think people are much more film literate now. You only have to look at special effects, for example, and rubber dinosaurs in horror movies, and now we expect dinosaurs to look like dinosaurs, damn it, like real ones, and they eat real other dinosaurs. But I think, bearing in mind the context of the time it was made, and the audiences would have received it in a slightly different way to the way we receive it now. So I guess, what do you say, a score?
It's a long way before we get the scores. Don't break the score in yet, please.
It would be a, but I won't.
Indeed. I mean, unless, of course, you want to move back in time, take the score back, and then actually continue going back in time until we get
now,
it right.
There's a thought.
As H.G. Wells actually said, do you still insist that this is all poppycock? To which Amy responds, that's not exactly the word I had in mind. There was profanity, obviously, in here, which I think of its time was quite interesting. Let's turn back to Pamela in terms of the thing, because it started off very much in the mode of really a kind of late 60s, early 70s Hammer horror movie. You could almost have seen Oliver Reed in the role. And it's interesting that characters or actors that were being put forward to take on board the role of Jack the Ripper, or indeed John Stevenson, included Mick Jagger and Edward Fox, who could have actually portrayed that particular role. In the end, Jagger lost out because it was felt he couldn't quite necessarily channel the Ripper lines from that perspective. But we move from there, obviously, to the dinner party. And again, lots of echoes of the George Powell 1960 movie, The Time Machine, which starts off in a dinner party, obviously with the traveller, who is a kind of cipher for H.G. Wells, who, of course, wrote the novel The Time Machine in 1895. So did you feel that, coupled with, of course, Nicholas Meyer's love for all things Sherlock Holmes and Sherlockian, lots of Easter eggs in terms of the name of the San Francisco inspector is actually named after an inspector in the Sherlock Holmes stories. We also have, of course, H.G. Wells taking on the line of Sherlock Holmes as his alter ego, which adds to the police's feeling that basically he's a complete lunatic. Did you feel that those tropes were useful? Did it kind of develop anything? And of course, that burgeoning line of women's rights and suffragettes having moved to successful things, and H.G.'s shock at how liberated women actually were. Free love, indeed.
Good grief.
Wow, goodness. What was the question? No, I'm kidding. So, to tell you the truth, I mean, I think, and I'm thinking of Jessica and I'm thinking of me, and I'm not trying to lump you in with me, Jessica, but I feel like there, and you're a considerable bit younger as well, but I feel like the things that we grew up with, it's almost like that was the television we grew up with. It was hammy, it was cheesy, it was over the top. It was, you know, it was very much like that. And personally, I like Mary Steenburgen, and I want to go back and see some other things she was in, because she was always regarded as a really great actor and American actor, honestly. So I feel like that there was a lot of talent, you know, there. I mean, it was definitely a bit zany and crazy and all of that. But I don't think I get very intellectual. Well, we all know that I don't with films. And it's really more of like, how does it hit you? Does it look and sound and feel right?
Yeah.
Does it take you on a trip? Does it make you invested in the characters? And, you know, I have to say, I was rooting for H.G. Wells and Amy. It was almost like I had this slight bit of like Doctor Who and traveling companion kind of thing. And she was great. She was all about women's lib, and she was really forward with him. And he was just such a gentleman, you know. And the relationship between the two was so very sweet. It was like romantic and sweet. And I actually didn't pick it apart and find fault with it. But part of that, I think, is also that I love Victorian garb. I love the whole Victorian thing. And I think that everything looks absolutely incredible. And the 70s and her huge hair and all, you know, just like the whole, I love the 70s as well.
Yeah.
So I just think that in my sort of uneducated watching it, it had my attention the whole time and I liked it. I don't, what does that with a movie, with one movie that everybody hates, and what doesn't do that with a movie that gets acclaimed? It all has to do with, I think, the person who watches it.
That's very true. And I think, again, going back to the context of time and when it was made and all that, I remember watching a film, I think it was in the theatre, and it was a film called It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And I do remember literally my sides and throat aching from laughter. I couldn't stop. I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen in all my life. And the kind of the very end chase and the way that it all resulted, I was in hysterics. And then it was on TV relatively recently, and I watched it and I thought, oh my goodness me, this is dreadful. It's awful. It's boring. What's funny? So it's the context of the time.
The good news, Philip, is we're not likely to be featuring It's a Mad, 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 Mad World in an upcoming Resonance Rewind, at least
a work
not
of
in this
art,
particular
a,
time.
A so. Work of art. A work
Clearly.
Of art.
Amy Robbins, I'm a 20th century woman. I have a career and a mind of my own. Be reasonable. How am I going to make it in 1893? Again, echoing sort of all points. And of course, it's interesting that Mary Steenburgen did, of course, go on to be the love interest for the Doc in the second and third episodes of the Back to the Future trilogy. So clearly her time traveling wasn't done in this and would actually head off into the 1980s. Jessica, you've heard really both ends of the spectrum from that perspective. As the narrative sort of developed from your own point of view, were you also rooting for HG and Amy? Or was it a case of secretly you felt it was time John Stevenson effectively came of his age and actually saw the violence that was present in 1970s America, particularly in San Francisco, and was just reveling in it?
Yeah, I think that actually I really liked Amy's character. I thought she was so fun. And yeah, she was just so like of her own mind. And I think that was really nice. And I think that I feel like some people might argue that her entire role was kind of to be his love interest and how she kind of left with him. But personally, I think that it's nice seeing how she can be very independent and stand up for herself while also wanting to be with him too. And that it's not mutually exclusive. I think that's really nice. And I do think that point that Jack the Ripper made about the 70s was so like, oh my goodness, it was so eerie when he was saying that, you know, back in the 1800s he was a freak for enjoying violence, but now he's an amateur with all of the mass spread of violence. That was disturbing. I mean, I feel like the 1800s had quite a lot of violence happening, but you know, I think it's more broadcasted now. But I had forgotten, like, or had never even considered that H.G. Wells was a contemporary of Jack the Ripper. Like, they lived in the same time period. That's so weird. I feel like Jack the Ripper has become so, I don't know, he was just a man who killed women, but he's become so prolific in, like, literature and films, and he's become a very mythologized kind of person. So it was like so crazy seeing him in a film, and really thinking about H.G. Wells as a real person made into this character, and
Yeah.
then Jack the Ripper as well. So I think it's very interesting, those layers.
The
I
lines
love the
of
little
the
side. I love the little side story where Malcolm McDowell was thinking, I might just model my vocal performance on the real H.G. Wells. And apparently he found a tape recording of H.G. Wells talking, and he didn't realize that he had a very high-pitched South London accent, which was very hard to replicate, would have sounded massively silly. So he decided to use his own voice, which I understand perfectly
Well,
well.
especially when we had the classic sequence where he went into the McDonald's fast food establishment, and obviously he thought it was a McDougal's, and he said, "I'll," and obviously tried to channel the American fries and aspect within that, and of course discovered fries, they're pommes frites, they're pommes frites. Again, the fish out of water scenario. Again, going back to Jessica's point, the line from David Warner's character of Stevenson, "We don't belong here. On the contrary, Herbert, I belong here completely and utterly. I'm home." Which, again, given 44 years ago, maybe we haven't really improved that much, really, but there we are. Okay, music, Pamela, Miklos Rozsa, a fairly well-known composer. Did you feel it kind of worked? I mean, I get the feeling that in many ways this is seen as a bit of a precursor to the whole notion of steampunk in many ways, really, as we actually put late Victorian characters into a contemporary setting.
Well, absolutely, but musically, I don't know. I think, again, it's just a very personal thing. But when I was little, I was so shy, I would hide under my mother's legs. And if a loud truck came by, I would run. I mean, it's a holdover from that. But when there's music that so goes from 0 to 90, 0 to 11, it's just so bombastic, and it's like bon, dun, dun, you know, it always makes me jump, and I don't enjoy that. I feel like it's kind of violent, and it's probably, you know, obviously for a reason. It's very dramatic, but I prefer films where there is no music for long stretches of time, and there's a lot of silence to give the audience time to be intelligent and work things out. But if there's all this like crazy bombastic music, punctuating everything, it's like exclamation marks big, you know, uppercase letters everywhere. It's a little unnerving. So yeah, I mean, it's great and brilliant, and you probably asked the wrong person because I didn't enjoy the music. The music was arresting, and it took away from, it was like someone shaking me during the whole thing.
I mean, maybe Rocha was actually channeling his inner John Williams and wanting to have a startling, wonderful thing. Because, of course, this movie launched 2 years after the whole ecosphere of movies were changed. Some might say, arguably forever, by the George Lucas behemoth of Star Wars and so on. So science fiction was actually back in vogue again, even slightly lower budget science fiction from this particular perspective. Let's talk characters. Jenny, are you a fan of John Stevenson? I suspect, obviously, as you've ripped this to shreds, you might have gone for the Jack the Ripper character, aka, just a thought. Or are you going to go for Charles Chaffee as Police Lieutenant Mitchell? Or would you indeed go for the aforementioned Inspector Gregson, who, of course, has appeared in Sherlock Holmes, Lines, etc.? Or have you got a completely different person, maybe even a soul portrayed by Patti d'Urbanville, who I'm sure Philip could actually say was once romantically intertwined with both Cat Stevens, Eric Clapton, and I think George Harrison,
She was a busy girl, wasn't she?
not necessarily at the same time, although let's not go into that personal
No,
side of things.
please,
Yeah.
please. Yes.
Where's your favorite character going to end up, Jenny?
I think my favorite character would have to be the H.G. Wells character. I thought that was he was the most like believable, rounded character. I do think that Mary Steenburgen, and I think she's a fabulous actress, and I liked some parts of her performance and her character, but I actually found a lot of the time when I couldn't stop thinking that she just was the spitting image of Kate Bush, I actually found her character a little bit irritating when she first started. But yeah, it would have to be the H.G. Wells character.
Even when he's eating ice cream that's melting because he's so shocked in the revolving restaurant in San Francisco, where he consistently seems to have the same backdrop of the Golden Gate Bridge behind him, etc. Or, as we like to say, this side of the Atlantic, that's just the Humber Bridge crossing the Humber Estuary, not the Golden Gate Bridge at all. There we are.
Good continuity there, yeah.
Jessica, favorite character from yourself, please.
I mean, I'm pretty torn between is it Hubert? Hubert, yes.
Herbert George
Herbert.
Wells.
Thank you. I kept wanting to call him Hubert. Herbert and Amy are like really tied in my mind because I like very different things about them, but I kept rooting for both of them within the story, and I was genuinely worried for their safety because I wanted both of them to make it to the end. But I think they were my favorites. I think they were just very charming and wholesome. I think he was just sweet, considering, I don't know, both their characters were just very sweet in a film where they were chasing a serial killer. So I thought that was a very nice little contrast to have. Made me appreciate them more.
You know, the sheer frustration when you literally have everything sorted out and you get a flat tire, how irritating that is. And then
Oh.
you try and warn the police, and of course you can't find a phone that works. You know, again, a pre-mobile phone era scenario. If only they'd actually come forward another 30 or 40 years, they wouldn't necessarily have had that challenge, or maybe they would have not had a signal in that particular area. It's just a thought. Nicholas Meyer, of course, who we mentioned before, directed and indeed wrote the screenplay for this particular epic, would go on to great acclaim to effectively relaunch the Star Trek franchise with Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan, and indeed co-write Star Trek for The Voyage Home. And when we do come around to The Voyage Home, there are a number of instances where, including the time travel sequence here, we see a lot of interesting connections between his 1979 offering Time After Time and 1986's Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Again, clearly a fan of Holmes, but also somebody who arguably, together with Harve Bennett, helped rescue the Star Trek franchise and keep it thrusting into the 22nd and third and fourth and indeed fifth centuries, etc.,
Oh,
let alone the 21st.
that's time
Philip,
travel for you.
character for yourself, please.
Well, I mean, not necessarily character, but just the way he played it. I think David Warner, not that I approve of Jack the Ripper's activities or his little hobbies, we'll draw a veil over those. But I just love it. I've always liked David Warner. I think he's so watchable. And I thought, although he did ham it up somewhat, he did the job as it should have been done, and I think as did the rest of the cast, really. They all joined in the fun, and it was clear, I think, from watching the film that, you know, everybody enjoyed what they were doing. They were having fun making it. They knew it was a riot, it was a send up. But I think David Warner, for me, because he's always so watchable, there's something about that face of his that, you know, always made you very compelled to keep your eyes on him on the screen.
And
But yeah,
indeed,
so.
in terms of contemporary films and structures with respect to that, 1979, in the same kind of zone as when a certain Educating Rita was actually being directed by Lewis Gilbert, amongst others from that thing, starring, I believe, a young Philip Hurdwood from that perspective. Isn't that right? From I mean, oh, 4 years later, 1983 was when that would be happening from that point of view.
Was it
So,
written 1983? My God,
I was
that
just
was a
wondering,
long
maybe you might
time
have
ago, wasn't
channeled
it? My
into your
goodness me.
character of Tiger, some kind of David Warner types, especially when he switched so effortlessly from his period of the Victorian, the Edwardian period, time period, right the way through to the trendy, long-haired, money belt wearing, sort of city slicker of San
Well,
Francisco.
absolutely. Well, it was on my mind, and I'm glad you were able to see that I had actually channeled that, Alexei. It's extremely very perspicacious of you. Thank you. Thank you for recognizing that. I think.
Pamela, your favorite character, please.
Wow. Okay. So he was really compelling and incredible, but it's hard for me to like the bad guy, even if he's amazing at being the bad guy. I feel like I'm rooting for him, and I don't want to root for him because he's bad. Who was the boy? There was a little boy, and he seemed to be in every single movie. Didn't he grow up? That was not Jeff Bridges. No, couldn't have been.
No.
No, 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 no.
He grew up to be like he was the kid. He was always the kid you saw on TV,
Yeah.
and I don't even
I
know
forget
who he was,
his name.
but. He had such a presence about him that even though he was just on for like a moment, I don't even remember when he was
So
on.
we're referring to the child who basically sort of identifies the strange man in the San Francisco exhibit of H.G. Wells,
Nobody paid attention.
and suddenly he sort of realizes that's the case. Again, I think sadly he did have a bit of a challenging time with respect to various issues of the way he was brought up, but I think we're referring to Corey Feldman,
Yeah.
who was the boy
Oh,
at the
yeah,
end.
I know.
It is Corey Feldman. Okay, but that's one of my favorite characters. So he gets an honorable mention in the spirit of Kathy. And the H.G. Wells, which Malcolm McDowell, which I really feel very stupid, but okay. Were he and Roddy brothers?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it's Roddy McDowall. No relation as
American.
yeah,
All right,
no.
I'm American. I get a pass.
They
So
were both
actually,
British, of course.
Yes, of course they were, yeah.
My favorite was Mary Steenburgen. I'm so in love with her. I mean, honestly, like she, and especially she was so young there. She just like moves her lip or her mouth, and at something about her, and she was really adorable. She did that kind of New York thing, even though they weren't in New York. She's just captivating. Like I just couldn't get whether she could act or not was almost immaterial. Like I just could not take my eyes off her. She was really
Oh,
captivating.
interesting.
She's my
Yeah.
favorite.
And again, arguably, what, 2 years after Kate Bush had effectively had her first major hit and was clearly in the ascendant. So maybe she was channeling some in Kate Bush the whole thing. Okay,
Or
now,
vice
Philip.
versa, or vice versa.
Indeed. Now we have the time you were waiting for where you can
Ah.
actually provide a score out of 10 for time after time.
Context is everything. Time is everything. The period in which it was made and received is everything. So I guess with all the fact that it was fun, it was intended to be fun and a caper, I think I'd probably give it a 7.
Pamela.
Oh, this is hard because I want to give it a 10 because it held my attention, and that's quite something. But I'm gonna give it an 8.5. I'm gonna give it an 8.5. Why, you ask? I don't know. I just am.
Strangely, I've been around the 7, 7.5 mark. I might go to 8 because 8 is, of course, a symbol for infinity, and we are in a time sequence here, so I think I might hold it on that basis. Let's go to way down the scale, Jenny Bill.
Yeah, give it 4.
There you go. No messing about. She shoots and maybe doesn't
A
score, but
good
never
score
mind.
from me.
Straight from the hip, that was.
Exactly. Lots of sensitivity into the whole system, a kind of what I refer to as an ice skater score, basically. Cold as, quite literally, in terms of the message. Jessica.
A solid 7.5, because again, I've mentioned before that time travel is not my usual like joy, but I think if it's steampunk and goofy, it gets a pass. And steampunk should be goofy, so it should always be a bit zany and out there. And I feel like that passed. This movie definitely did. So I think it's a good one.
Excellent.
And they went back in time, of course, as well. Every age is the same, as H.G. Wells said, in his character, in this movie. It's only love that makes any of them bearable. So maybe there is a message there in terms of the system that, whatever line we're actually based with or faced with, we still have those challenges within the whole field.
Absolutely. I was going to go on to say briefly that, if you, as I said earlier today at one point to someone, I said, if you put a cup of instant coffee into a microwave, would you go back in time? And it's one of those questions that needs a little bit of thought, I think.
And that's why we like you on the program. That's why you provide that quirky element when you're not talking over people, Philip, that to actually sort of it adds that whole quality. It's okay. It's
Oh,
okay.
oh.
Yes. I always have the mute button, which I rarely outmanifest, but if forced, I would. But it's okay. That's part of the whole thing. Next week, Jessica, we're still in time, but we're back in one of Jenny's favorite series, The Time Tunnel. As we hedge down the line with Tony Newman and Doug Phillips, two American scientists lost in the infinite reaches of the corridor of time, where are they going to end up? They're going to end up in the Alamo. Do we remember the Alamo? Of course,
Oh,
we remember the
gosh, yes.
Alamo.
Yes, it had John Wayne.
Well, not in the actual Alamo, Jenny. That was just obviously John Wayne was a wonderful actor, but or indeed, he, but he or indeed Marion Morrison, his alter ego, or his original name. But ultimately, he wasn't actually at the Alamo. He might have connected on that sort of things. We'll clarify that and more in the next edition of Resonance Rewind. So to Pamela Sue Mann, to Jenny Bill, to Jessica Burtis, to Philip Hurdwood, huge thanks. We're going to listen to again the suite from Time After Time with Miklós Rucha. Pamela will probably switch off at this particular moment. And we say those immortal words, keep on resonating.